I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Most cities have attempted to revive a collection of historic buildings. Many have tried to create new entertainment districts, and most aspire to have a place enjoyed equally by diverse people. But few cities have attempted to do all three at the same time in the same place. Fewer still have succeeded. But developer John Elkington has done that for the city of Memphis with Beale Street, and he'll tell us about it today on Smart City. Also with us are Denise Ballheimer and Dr. Jim Bailey, who are determined to improve the health of their fellow citizens through the efforts of Healthy Memphis Common Table. It's a unique effort to tackle healthy lifestyles through environmental change. That's today on Smart City, but first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. John Elkington is a most unlikely developer of the Beale Street Entertainment District in Memphis. He was a Memphis condo developer who was drafted into service to revive what was left of the historic center of black entertainment in the Mid-South after urban renewal got through with it. John is CEO of Performa Entertainment Real Estate. John, described the condition of Beale Street when you first became involved.
Well, I think, Carol, it was much like downtown Beirut during the height of the Lebanese War. I think that's the best description of it. Most of the buildings had really fallen in very serious disrepair. Obviously, after the death of Dr. King, which was precipitated, I think, by a march on Beale Street. His last public march was on Beale Street, came back to Memphis, it was assassinated, and then there were riots in Memphis, and there was a general decline. And then I think there was a true gentrification of the whole area. And one of the great things that should never happen is the Housing Authority then came into the famous urban renewal period of Memphis history and started tearing down buildings and came up with a number of different plans that were unsuccessful. And so at the time, it was really a very bad situation.
Had it been part of your personal history?
Beale Street, not really. You know, I think Beale Street, when I first came to Memphis in the late 60s, it was such a famous street, and it was in such disrepair. It interests me as someone who is interested in development and in redaptive uses of buildings, and because of the history and because of what took place there, and it was interesting. But I really had never, as a child, because I didn't live in Memphis, visit Beale Street. But it was really the lore and the history of the street.
You had been a housing developer. I guess you had maybe done some mixed use projects at the time, but what made you think you could develop Beale Street?
Actually, it was youth did it, and I was 32 years old at the time, and I had just finished a project called Lenox School, and Lenox School was a very successful project. In days when interest rates were at 18%, we sold the development out in about 2 weeks, and it was a terrific project that actually is still my favorite project of all times. But it was because of the adaptive reuse of the buildings that the mayor of Memphis at the time thought that there was a similarity between Lenox School and Beale Street and asked us if we would get involved. And quite honestly, at the time in the early 80s, 1982, there was as you're well aware, there was a great movement among a lot of the progressive people in the community to try to change downtown. And we had the jobs conference, as you remember, in the early 80s. And there was an attempt to try to make something out of downtown. And it was the challenge, really, that interested me in getting involved. And I remember I made a list of 100 black leaders in Memphis to go visit them to try to find out about Beale Street. And when I visited them, you know, they had such vivid memories. And I remember many times they would tell us about a place called the One Minute, which was a hot dog place that was on Beale Street, and remembering the smells of the onions and the hot dogs. And interestingly enough, that business went out of existence in 1929, and most of those people could never ever have gone there. And it was just the lore was so great about the street that that was part of the initial situation we were faced with, and we had to balance the thoughts of the African American community, and trying to get anyone to come downtown at that time was of course very difficult. And but we made that list. We visited all those people, and then we started to visiting people like Jim Rouse. And I remember spending a day with him in Columbia, Maryland, and trying to get him involved with us in this project. And he advised me not to get involved in a project that musicians had things to do with. We developed a plan, and we sent out three very specific goals. We said, look, we're going to return commerce to the street. We're going to make sure that it becomes the music center of the region. And the third thing is we're going to make sure there are no barriers, real or imaginary, that would be set up or be visible to anybody. So we wanted to make sure there was participation by every group in Memphis. And we worked very hard, obviously, to get African-American owners and African-American managers, and that has been really, I think, the strength of the project. 35% of our owners on Beale Street are African-Americans.
You are alluding to it, John, but for listeners who don't know, give me a quick history of Beale Street and its significance to the African-American community.
Beale Street basically was the main street for African Americans in the 1920s, 1930s. It was a very bawdy place. It had many houses of prostitution. There was gambling. It was one of the few free streets that African Americans could do just about anything they wanted to do in a segregated South. That changed, of course, when in 1954, when the Brown decision and segregation started to break down a little bit in the South, there were other shopping opportunities available for African Americans, and there were other entertainment opportunities available. And so the population, African American population in downtown Memphis, migrated to other portions of Memphis, North Memphis, South Memphis. So Beale Street fell in a little bit of disrepair. And while the African Americans were the customers of Beale Street, the majority of owners were ethnic groups, Jews, Poles, various Italians, various ethnic groups in Memphis owned the buildings. They lost some interest in it, and it basically became pawn shops, and the really good tenants began to move out, and it had a slow decline. And then it was the real final decline was in 1968, during the civil rights era, when Martin Luther King came to Memphis. He had his last public march down Beale Street, and it ended in a riot, and a lot of the buildings were destroyed. That, I think, became a symbol to many whites in Memphis that we got to do something about this. And what they did is they got federal dollars, urban renewal dollars in those days, and started emptying all of the remaining businesses on Beale Street and began to board it up. And it was boarded up basically for 12 years.
Wow. You said that Beale Street, one of the keys to the success of Beale Street is that you have 35% minority ownership. You have a lot of local businesses on Beale Street, locally owned businesses, one-of-a-kind businesses. How did you nurture those businesses? In fact, they seem to be, they are what built Beale Street, made it exciting again, and still seem to outperform the chains.
Actually, it is very important, I think, when doing any entertainment district, that you look to the local music and history and culture. The idea of putting, and I say this respectfully, putting Applebee's Chili's in the Macaroni Grill on Beale Street would have been a travesty. And so we did concentrate on getting musicians. We worked for 7 years to get B.B. King to be involved in a club on Beale Street. But we started things like the Rum Boogie Cafe, which were local, and really, Carol, at the height of really despair in 1985, when things weren't working very well. There, a lot of the planned projects for downtown did not happen, and we were struggling. I sat down in a hotel room in Los Angeles with one of our partners, and with Preston Lamb, and we said, look, we've got to come up with an idea of doing our own club, because we can't find tenants that want to come downtown. Let's develop our own club. And so we developed the Rum Boogie, and it was a very important turning point because it was the music and had the feel that we wanted to accomplish.
I don't know where you saw a market for Beale Street in 1982. Things were really grim in downtown Memphis. And then 3 years later, you still hadn't been able to crack the nut. So you said, well, we'll open a club on our own, something that represents our vision for Beale Street and other clubs there. Again, there certainly was no proven market. There were no comparables. How did you, I mean, was this all on faith?
I think all developers have to work on faith. And we had done a very detailed business plan in 1981 when we first started looking this in October of 1981. And, you know, I think the adage that if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there is really true. And I think in this particular case, we stuck to a basic principle and we believed in the product. We were probably too optimistic on the further growth of downtown, but we were basically willing to risk everything. We were willing to risk our reputation, the money that we had accumulated to make this succeed. And many days we were really concerned whether we would make it. But we never lost faith on the concept that if you build a project that has the music and culture and history of a region, and Memphis has a fabulous history and great culture and a great musical history, that you would be successful. And it just took longer, quite honestly, than we thought. And we learned a great deal since then. And it's making it easier for us to do other developments because there are several principles you got to stick to be successful.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is John Elkington. He is the developer of Beale Street and president of Performa Entertainment Real Estate. John, you're now tackling projects with similar challenges around the country. Where are you working?
We are doing a project called The Foundry in Trenton, New Jersey, which is very similar to Beale Street. It's the old Roebling steel plant. John Roebling was the creator of the Brooklyn Bridge and was involved in the Golden Gate Bridge, and a great American who was a very visionary and one of the great industrialists. We're doing that project, which is 120,000 square feet of entertainment. We're building apartments there, which are the first new apartments in Trenton in 30 years. And we're very excited about that. We're underway. We're building a project in Jackson, Mississippi, 173 acres, redeveloping an area two block from the Capitol. It's called Ferris Street. And we're building the first housing in Jackson, new housing in probably 40 years. And we're doing an entertainment district of about 120,000 square feet that concentrates really on the history and the music of Mississippi. And there's a great history there, obviously. And we have some wonderful buildings. We have the building where Martin Luther King met during the civil rights era, had numerous meetings. We have the office building that Medgar's ever had at 151 and a half Ferris Street. We just have a number of just historic buildings that are important to the culture of the regions, where Trumpet Record, where Sonny Boy Williamson recorded all his great songs. So it's exciting there. We're also involved in a project in Virginia outside of Washington in Fredericksburg, which is a little different from what we've done. But again, it is a very historic place, and we're doing, it's called Celebrate Virginia. And we're really embracing the culture of the state of Virginia and the music of the state of Virginia.
So many cities have historic districts that they desperately want to re-energize and redevelopment, but they can't quite seem to get them off the ground. Why? What typically stands in the way?
Well, I think there's five things that you've got to be able to do to be successful in redeveloping area. Number one, you have to have the support of government. You know, these projects are too big, they're too complicated, they have too many infrastructure problems to be successful without the help of government. If you cannot get the assistance of the mayor and the city council or the political leadership of a community, if you can't get them to buy in, you shouldn't waste your time, because it is very critical. The second thing is these are policing issues. If you look at Underground Atlanta, if you look at Rush Street in Chicago, if you look at Laclede's Landing in St. Louis, or in Beale Street in Memphis, all of them have security issues that you have to address. And if you can't get the police department to buy in to what you're doing, that you will have crowds, and that means you'll have people, and people will be eating and drinking and having a good time. If you can't get them to buy in, it makes it very difficult. And the third thing is, in most markets, you have to have a group of potential customers, either conventioneers or leisure travelers or group travelers or people that live in the MSA or business travelers. You've got to have a group. If you don't have that, you probably can't sustain a development. Not every city can be like Orlando, Florida, or San Diego, where you have just huge tourists coming to an area. Most cities that we look at and want entertainment districts don't have those large tourist populations coming in. So you have to take every group, and you've got to expand all those five groups as much as you can. And I think the fourth thing that you've got to make sure is you've got to have a very specific tenant plan. And it should include regional tenants and local tenants. And sometimes you have to go to people and say, here's what we're trying to do here. Would you be interested in doing this concept? We just did this in Virginia. We're interested in, obviously, Virginia music. And we met with the Ella Fitzgerald Estate. And we've now made an arrangement where the estate will have a club called Fitzgerald's. And we put together the operator and we put together the estate. And it will really be a great history of her music and what she contributed to American music. And I think the fifth thing that you've got to be able to do is you've got to have a game plan and be very specific and let everyone know, your lenders, the city, your customers, that here's what we're trying to create here. And that, a lot of times, is the failings, that people's expectations of what they're going to see or what they're going to experience is not what has been portrayed. And so we're very careful now, not always that way, but we're very careful in to set expectation levels correctly.
Entertainment districts have attracted a lot of attention since you've entered the business. At one point, the huge themed entertainment places like Rainforest Cafe and Planet Hollywood were the rage, and then they didn't work out so well. And then the multiplex fun places like Buster's were going to be the anchors. And then it was the movie plexes. And Beale Street has none of those, but it seems to be standing the test of time.
Actually, we're increasing our business. I think the reason why is because we're genuine and we're real. And I think the problem with many of the concepts in the 1990s were not real, and they get tired early. I think that when you have music and dancing and good food, those are the key elements. And I think the idea that you can charge $10 for a hamburger and just because you're in a rainforest doesn't make it so, and doesn't make it good. And I think the genuineness is important. And I think as we get older, as our population ages, I think people are looking for that experience. And it is an experience that you've got to look and feel things that are important to your past. And we're very conscious of that. That, there is something to listening to Percy Sledge, "When a Man Loves a Woman." I mean, there is something to that. And there is a feeling of dancing. And I think you've got to make sure that you have all of those elements and that you have public gathering places that everyone can go to and everyone can feel comfortable in and everyone can enjoy the moment. And I think all those are important.
When you say it's genuine, it is genuine. It's funny talking to people about Beale Street around the country who've never been there. And you say it's the attachment to history. It's the dancing. It's the people in some ways, I guess, making their own fun, entering into the moment. Anything else, John, that you think really helps convey authenticity and a feeling that it's genuine, it's real?
Well, I think the street performers, and I think that all those are important. And I think it's allowing your tenants to be as creative as possible. Most restaurants have a tendency to go to the lowest denominator. if people are selling country fried steak and it's doing well, let's all sell that. And I think you've got to be able to coordinate that a little bit and put some restrictions on what people can do. You want every experience to be unique because we live in an experience economy. I mean, really do. I mean, people are looking for things that are different. And if eliminating all of the security issues and all the parking issues and those kind of things, saying that you do those perfectly, still you have to have an experience where you can see a individual playing a guitar on the street. Doesn't cost you anything to do that. Or you can go into Handy Park any night and see a free concert. And they're not just good concerts, they're great concerts. And they're real people from the Mississippi Delta, or they're real people from the region who are playing there. And I think that is important. I think it's also making sure you don't get caught up into trends. And there's a lot of that where, you know, in the 70s, and we were caught up in the 80s and 90s, there's always been very trendy establishments, as you mentioned before. And you got to be careful not to do that. I mean, for years, Hooters wanted to be on Beale Street. I said, no, even though it would be a great lease, it would, you know, be profitable. We're not interested in that. That's not something we're interested in. We're interested in things that have a longevity. And you have to be very careful that you don't get caught up in things that are not going to last for a while.
What's the biggest mistake you made?
Basically, I didn't know what I was doing in the sense that I didn't realize how complicated it was. And really, when we entered into an agreement with the city to develop it, it was set up in such a way as they knew we would fail or expected us to fail. And it was a very one-sided agreement on our part, because they never thought we'd last more than 4 or 5 years. It was designed that the city wouldn't have to put any more money into Beale Street, and there would not be any longevity. We should have had a much more comprehensive document to talk about the future, and that's what we're doing now. We've approached the city about, let's restructure this. Let's make this a fairer document, and let's address the problems that we're going to have in the next 25 years of this agreement. I think those are important. Today, I have a much greater experience on what the problems are and what the solutions are. The second thing is you got to be very careful on filling space. Don't ever be in a hurry to go find or fill a space with a tenant. Make sure you get the right tenant and he understands what you're looking for. And I think those two things are I think, the things that you can learn from this experience. We didn't do everything right in the beginning, but we learned and we stuck to the basic premise. We were very correct in what we wanted, to return commerce, to make sure we're the music center of the region, and to make sure that there were no barriers, real or imaginary.
Is Beale Street today what you hoped it would be?
I think it's more than I hoped it would be. As we look at the new Westin Hotel, one floor from being topped out, as the new garage, as we see Morgan Freeman moving in to our development, as we see the kind of the trends of things, I'm much happier than I thought I could ever be about this project. And people believe now that people use Beale Street as an example. People use Memphis as an example. And today, it's just it's amazing what's happening there.
John, thanks for talking with us about Beale Street. And thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Always great to be with you.
John Elkington is CEO of Performa Entertainment Real Estate. After a short break, we'll return to talk about how to make a whole city healthier with our guest from Healthy Memphis Common Table. And we'll talk to Otis White about the fine art of walking. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, as you know, walking is one of my favorite pastimes, and I love the fact that some people have elevated walking into this notion of the flaneur. Tell me about it.
Well, it sure sounds a lot better than being a walker. Wouldn't you rather be known as a flaneur than a walker? And you'd sure rather be known as a flaneur than a photo blogger. And that's really what is sort of driving this. A little historical background is probably needed here. Back in the mid-1800s, back in the 1850s, Napoleon III, who was in charge of France in those days, decided that he really didn't much like the way that Paris looked. And so he commissioned a brilliant builder and early urban planner, a guy named Haussmann, to make the city that we now associate with Paris come to life. This was dramatic. This is urban renewal on a vast scale. They bulldozed medieval parts of the city, and they created the long, straight, wide boulevards that we associate with Paris today. This happened so quickly and so dramatically that it gave rise to, I guess you would call them dandies, gentlemen strollers of the street, and in a more innocent time that didn't have a bad connotation to it. The poet Charles Baudelaire called them flaneurs, and it basically just means people who walk around the city, admire it, look at it, critically review it, because so much dramatically was going on at that time, and then compare notes. So, all right, let's jump ahead more than 100 years, 150 years, and talk about what's happening today. Today, we have these people who are called photo bloggers, and you know what a blogger is. That's a person who kind of keeps a diary online, and the difference with a photo blogger is that they take photographs, and a large part of their blog are photographs. And what they increasingly are doing these days is they're walking around cities, taking pictures of little urban details, putting them on their website, and it's encouraging people to get out and see their city. And somebody along the way resurrected this old term, flaneur, for the amateur stroller of the streets who takes notice of what's going on, and in this case photographs it, puts it on a blog, people share it, and now the next step is they're organizing sort of large groups that travel in a group and see these things, often led around by the photographs that are on these blogs. So it's really developing some grassroots interest in architecture and urban planning, and that's actually a very good thing in cities these days.
It's a very good thing. I just love this idea.
I wish I'd thought of it, and I wish I'd thought of that word a long time ago.
Well, I guess we can both jump in and be flaneurs. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Denise Bollheimer and Dr. Jim Bailey decided they could make a difference in the health of their fellow citizens, and to do so, they created Healthy Memphis Common Table. Denise is the former board chair of the organization, and Jim is division chief of general internal medicine at the University of Tennessee. Denise, what do you hope to accomplish with Healthy Memphis Common Table?
We want to improve the health of people in the Mid-South. And when we say health, we don't say just health care. There's a difference between health and health care. If you consider that 99.999% of your life is outside of a doctor's office or a hospital, then we need to affect behavior and your environment outside of a doctor's office and a hospital, which means that we need a way to improve your environment and behavior in a school, in a church, in a business, on the streets, exercising, wherever you have a life. And so that's what we're trying to do. And so initially we're focusing on obesity and diabetes because that impacts so many people. But in the long run, what we're hoping is that what we do is a model for other things, other community problems. So it might be infant mortality or cancer, or it could be non-health care issues that affect health. It could be crime or other issues, sexually transmitted diseases, other issues.
Now, it's interesting because you both come out of the University of Tennessee Medical Group. Jim, you're a doctor. I'm wondering how you and your colleagues responded to this notion of, okay, now we're going to go outside the physician's office and we're going to affect the environment and the behavior in that environment that is outside of what happens between me and my patient.
Yes. You're really asking what has been the response of the traditional medical community to that. You know, I think overall it's been amazingly positive. I think physicians frequently feel powerless to control the things and affect the things that most affect the lives of their patients, because those are determined by the environment and their behaviors and by the schools, whether or not the school has PE for children. Those sorts of things may be some of the most important factors for health. But really, physicians can't do a lot to affect those things most of the time. So I think one of the things that we've found is we've created a real excitement in the provider community amongst doctors, hospitals, and so forth, because they've seen this as a way to come together with business people, employers, with people from the schools, and think together about ways that we can make Memphis a healthier place.
Mm-hmm. Healthy Memphis Common Table, that is a mouthful. What's the significance of the Common Table part of that name?
The name first came up, the idea of a Common Table came up from this wonderful doctor named Bob Waller, who was the outgoing chair of Mayo Clinic, and he decided to retire in Memphis. And so he kept talking about how to get healthcare providers around a common table. We started thinking, saying, we need to get the community around a common table to address health needs. And so eventually it became the Healthy Memphis Common Table, because that says what we want to accomplish by getting people around the table. And so in reality, what happened was that there were lots of coalitions in certain groups, but they weren't talking to each other. They weren't working together. And so what we were able to do is bring many coalitions together, along with businesses, major employers, churches, individuals, anybody who wanted to work with us to improve health around a common table. And it actually started more or less around a dining room table, and then just kept growing and growing and growing. So one coalition would join, and then another one and another one.
I know the two of you have been at this since day one. What was your original motivation for this?
I would go back to thinking about my own initial frustration as a physician that I described to you, that I think is common to many physicians, that we really have felt unable to really contribute adequately to the health of the community because we're pushing pills like mad. And I think most doctors agree that we're still not really making great strides to beating the major health problems in the community. So many people around the country have seen that our health system is sickness-focused and not prevention-focused, that we spend so much time treating the problems of unhealthful living and so little time creating healthy places to live. So I think for me and for most of us, the original motivation was to bring together leaders and people who could help change our approach in our own community to create a more prevention-focused health system, and also one that empowered the individual to take control of their own health. Now, several of my colleagues and I put together a report for Tennessee about the obesity and diabetes epidemic. And one problem we faced early on, I think, is our efforts were, we weren't sure where to start. You know, how do you start in something that big? And what Denise Bollheimer and many other people said, you know, we've got to identify the crux issue in our own community. And what we discovered in our own community was the most important root cause of the health problems facing Memphians in terms of coronary disease, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, peripheral vascular disease, atherosclerosis, all those things that we've treated as different diseases. We saw the root cause was diabetes and obesity, which are one in the both together sort of one in the same thing on the most part. 90% of diabetes is weight associated. And we've been experiencing a real plague of this disease and this problem in this community. So that was where we really got geared up to start.
Well, let's talk about diabetes for a minute and obesity, as you say, one and the same problem. How do you get your arms around that and move to a prevention mode rather than a treatment mode? Who has to be at the table? Because I can think of so many contributors. I mean, everything from the way we plan our communities, whether we're car dependent, whether we encourage walking on a daily basis, what kind of healthy food is available, readily accessible and affordable to people. I'm sure there are lots of other issues, but I know regular exercise and good eating has to be, what, Jim, 80% of the game?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, so who has to be at the table to figure those problems out?
Well, I think the first thing we had to do was bring the entire community together to wake people up that it was a real problem. We had to have people understand that the problem that we recognized is real and it impacts them. So what we tried to do is identify partners, create strategic alliances with partners, and find partners that could help us get the message out, educate the community, and then develop ways to not only educate people, but to get them to change behavior and so forth.
Because those are not the same thing.
Exactly.
Right? I can know that eating that bag of potato chips is not good for me, but I may eat it anyway, right?
Absolutely.
Yep.
So one of our issues was, how do we make a business case for these business partners to get involved? How do we get a partner to want to work with us? And so we kept looking and saying, well, if I were a church, how would I feel if people couldn't tithe because they're not working and they don't have income, or they can't get involved in my committees, or how much, in particularly in a Christian-oriented or Judeo-Christian community, you're supposed to help your fellow man. So we were trying to find different motives from a partner's perspective on why they should become involved, and then reach to their constituencies, their members, their followers through them, and they let them take the message to people. And so that, I think, is the beauty of the Common Table, is that we try to make the community partners successful in doing what they were already doing, but we give them more partners, more resources, networking, ideas, things that have already been used in other communities to do that.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Denise Bollheimer. She is Vice President of Marketing and Managed Care at UT Medical Group and Chair of Healthy Memphis Common Table. Dr. Jim Bailey is Division Chief of General Internal Medicine at the University of Tennessee, and he is the founding board chair of Healthy Memphis Common Table. I can understand where employers have real skin in this game, because they are paying for health care costs and they are losing productive days. So, I mean, there's a huge incentive for employers to encourage healthy lifestyles, to do anything they can to encourage healthy lifestyles. There's a whole segment of the community that weighs on the public till, if you will, whether they're using the health clinics, the public hospital, or they're simply on Medicare. Have you been able to touch that system in a way that begins to provide the same sort of incentive or encouragement to the constituents or to the end users, the consumers, if you will, of health care?
Well, I think that there's two angles to that. One is that a lot of them are covered by a government plan. And so we've tried to engage people that are involved with those managed care organizations to work with us to reach those people, to be able to communicate with them, and to make sure that the people have the access to the care that they need. Part of the problem that many of the people have is that they're not recognized in the system early enough. And if someone, even let's say it's a dentist who notices early tooth decay in a child, well, it might have been because the mom was giving a 3-year-old some sort of purple-colored juice in her bottle as opposed to what she should be drinking. If we engage enough of the healthcare providers and the insurance companies that serve that group of people, we'll be able to reach them as well. Another thing is that we've tried to be very grassroots in what we're doing, and a lot of the people are not happy with their environment. They are afraid to go out and exercise because it's frightening. The pavement is broken. There's not adequate lighting. The church locks up the gymnasium and they can't go exercise. There's an environmental, political, social kind of environment that we need to address in order to make it possible for those people to have a good lifestyle. And so a lot of the people that are really in the kind that you're talking about are very interested in what we're doing because they say, maybe this is going to make a better neighborhood for me, and that we need to address things on the neighborhood level, at the church level where people congregate.
Two things. Have you been able to engage City Hall and the planners at City Hall around these issues?
Yes. Memphis has been wonderful. We have the Shelby County government here, and now they have a regional health council that is planning where their priorities are. And I'm pleased to announce that we are on the regional health council, and a lot of the regional health council members are part of the common table. And there is now a committee specifically to address the problems of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and stroke. And so we've brought a lot of people in government together with others to start finding new solutions.
And they're not just dealing with care. They're also now thinking prevention.
Exactly.
That's great.
We have people like from the Council on Aging. We have people from the Meals on Wheels, MIFA, which is the local organization that does that program, wonderful program, mainly for seniors and people who are shut in. So I think that our government, including our state government, we had a really large summit that was January 21st of 2006, where we brought 1,100 people on their own time on a Saturday morning to talk about childhood obesity. And guess who came? It was our governor and the commissioner of health for Tennessee, as well as our county mayor. And he even got in front of the public and inspired them doing, I think it was 51 push-ups in front of everybody in his suit, saying, you don't need a fancy place to exercise. He does his age every day, apparently, in push-ups. And so each year he keeps adding another push-up. But he had already done his push-ups, and he did more.
I am very impressed. Okay, I want to ask you about another issue that's really touchy in a lot of communities. When you start talking about prevention, couple of things. One, removing soft drinks from schools. That's a touchy one because a lot of schools reap income, very much needed income, from the sale of those drinks. What have you been able to do in Memphis?
We have a wonderful group of people called the Pediatric Wellness Council, and they have been at Le Bonheur, meeting at Le Bonheur, and it's a group of people from all walks of life that come together to talk about problems. They joined up with some nutritionists and statewide, and along with some of our physicians in the city, and worked towards getting legislation to at least have soft drinks, sugary soft drinks, taken out of the schools from the kindergarten through the eighth grade, and I believe it went into effect August 2005. Also, this same group, along with others, have enacted some legislation to mandate that we have physical education again in Tennessee. So things are really happening in a very positive way. But also, I think it's worth noting that the schools and the PTAs and PTOs are really becoming very aware of the obesity problem. And so, for instance, it's my understanding that the Shelby County PTA group, they're working on generating ideas on fundraising without using sugary snacks, candy, and other things for their booster clubs. And so they're working on how can we accomplish things selling gift wrap or other fun things without creating a hazard for children and the families.
Interesting. Jim, I want to ask you, when you studied obesity and diabetes, I don't know how many of the studies were yet available, but it seems that I've been seeing some studies coming out recently that show a very direct link between obesity and the access to fast food.
Yes.
And I think there was a recent study that came out about Memphis on this just in the last few weeks. Did you do that study or were you involved?
Well, actually, our university and my group, and specifically in conjunction with the University of Memphis, has been conducting a survey called the Memphis Behavioral Risk Factor Survey and really looking at eating patterns in Memphis and access to fast foods. And what we found was that the neighborhoods where there's lots of ready access to fast food had the highest rates of obesity and overweight. And this sort of thing, of course, it's not direct proof that having fast food leads to an unhealthier neighborhood, but there's lots of evidence from lots of sources. And I think virtually everyone agrees now that fast food, eating fast food on a regular basis, is not the healthiest way to live. And drinking sweetened drinks or sweet drinks, even fruit juice all the time, which is a very high caloric food, is probably not the healthiest thing to do. So what I think people are realizing around the country, and this is individuals like you and me, not just researchers, is that we all have skin in this game. And that if we're concerned about our own health and we don't want to be having bypass surgery and bad knees, and if we want to live abundant life into our older age, we want to look for and demand in our schools, in our workplace, healthy food choices. And healthy food choices are mostly natural foods. And it's pretty hard to find fresh fruits and vegetables in many areas of Memphis. Those same neighborhoods that we found had the biggest problems with obesity. But I have to say, even Germantown, you know, our wealthiest neighborhoods, have a huge problem with overweight and obesity and poor eating habits. It's much easier when you're on the rush, going from work, working two jobs perhaps, to grab a hamburger than it is to find fresh fruit and vegetables that haven't been cooked in grease and who knows what else.
We don't want to know.
So we're trying to find ways through some of our projects with the restaurants to reward restaurants, grocery stores, convenience stores that offer healthy food choices. And we think that's critical to creating a healthier community, is really having public demand for good food.
Yeah. It's been interesting in Chicago. The best chefs in Chicago make a real point of buying from the farmers markets there. And then they make it a badge of honor. And it's like, I buy healthy on the day, you're getting it fresh to the table. And it's become a value add in those restaurants, which I think is interesting and really, I think, again, becomes one of those incentives that you're looking for to encourage people to do the right thing. We're running out of time. I want to ask you both really quickly, just for a short answer. If you were giving advice to another community that wanted to begin doing some of the same things you're doing, where would they begin?
I think the first thing is not try to do too much too soon. That start building on relationships and have some small wins first. Don't be too disappointed if you don't change everything overnight. That it is possible to get people together, and it's so much has to do with relationship building. And it's what's so wonderful about what's going on in Memphis now is that you keep going to other meetings, different groups, and it's the same people again. So you've built relationships to the point where you're on a first name basis. And when you can communicate well with each other and you know that you share some common goals, you'll be able to get some things done together.
Good. Jim?
We're also very eager to work with other communities to share best practices, some of which they have to bring to us. We think that that learning community adds a lot and can help make us all more effective. So we're eager to hear from other communities that are struggling with some of the same problems. And we're trying, through the Healthy Memphis Common Table and something we're trying to put together called the Healthy City, to build coalitions of cities that are struggling with these same sorts of issues.
I want to thank you both for what you're doing. Again, I've seen this vision grow from just a vision to reality. The reality is very exciting, very promising. Thank you both for being on Smart City.
Thank you.
Denise Bollheimer and Dr. Jim Bailey are organizers of Healthy Memphis Common Table. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith says two unfortunate incidents have given his family a new appreciation for their neighborhood.
There is a yield sign merging traffic at a busy intersection near my house. Cars often back up there. When you get to the head of the line, you have to pick an opening and step on it. Not too long ago, I was there in line, and as I got to the front, the car ahead of me pulled off. So I glanced to my left, saw an opening, and accelerated right into the back of the car ahead of me. Because no sooner had that driver pulled away than he got cut off and had to stop. Looking the other way, I didn't see this. My car sat at the shop for 6 weeks before it could get fixed. In the meantime, though, my wife and I still had her car. 2 weekends later, she and I were headed to the airport one morning for a week-long trip when her car abruptly lost power and slowed to a sluggish crawl. We limped home just in time to catch a cab and make our flight. When we got back, her car was towed in, and there it sat for 2 weeks until it could be fixed. All of a sudden, we had no cars, which in most of car-addicted Atlanta can mean total isolation and even near starvation. But luckily, our neighborhood is different, something we didn't fully appreciate until we were without a car. You can walk anywhere for anything in our neighborhood and enjoy doing so. A drugstore is around the corner, just down the street from numerous restaurants and shops. A grocery store is only a few blocks more. Bus stops that I had never noticed through the glare on my windshield are everywhere. In 20 minutes, a bus can connect you to a train that goes directly to the airport, which is essential for me since I travel so much. For 2 weeks, we lived without a car and never once felt stranded or cut off. Indeed, we discovered an aspect of life that we almost never encountered before: the texture and character of gardens, porches, and street corners, the relaxed pace and car radio-free moments of a stroll through the neighborhood, the chance to think and reflect instead of the frenzy of traffic, just the exercise of being out on foot, running errands, and seeing others. For a long time now, cars have been a necessity that most of us can't do without, even for a day. We are experts at navigating parking lots, interstates, and drive-thrus. Driving distance defines our space, driving time our time. Gasoline prices depress our mood, and our neighborhoods can even look like little more than byways and parking spaces for our cars. Not that cars are bad, far from it. But life behind the wheel passes by too many other pleasures and experiences. So maybe we should put our cars in park more often. Perhaps there is nothing like car trouble to show us the real trouble with cars and to remind us that there are many ways of getting around. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart City's web content and audio archive is supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders working to speed innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.